and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2735 and call Darrell Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Darrell Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. You have written testimony in front of you that I'll summarize briefly. We worked awful hard, we being the auto dealers and representatives for the manufacturers, who are Larry Campbell for General Motors and Tom Gallagher for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, on rewriting our franchise law, which is the statute that governs the relationship between dealers and manufacturers. The bill went through, I think, 7 or 8 drafts through legislative counsel on the House side, working with the bill lit subcommittee on the House Commerce Committee before we were finally able to reach an agreement. I can tell you that House Bill 2735A engrossed has the support of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association and General Motors. The Alliance of American Automobile Manufacturers is neutral, and the Department of Justice has indicated that they have no opposition to the bill. It basically revises the franchise law, which has not been substantially changed in about 15 years, making about 10 changes to the franchise law. Probably the most significant change is that it prevents the factories from engaging in price fixing. That is something that has been, until last year, considered a per se violation of federal antitrust laws, but a recent Supreme Court decision indicated that factories could begin to establish certain maximum prices. This was actually a petroleum case that went before the U.S. Supreme Court, but it had a collateral impact on most other businesses. And so we are establishing a statute that the factories cannot engage in price fixing. We've also substantially clarified the rules under which a dealer can sell a franchise. As you know, the auto dealer industry is in a consolidation mode. Dealers are selling out to other dealers. When you sell a franchise, you're required to have manufacturer approval. And under current law, it simply says that the manufacturers cannot unreasonably withhold approval. But it gave no guidance to what unreasonably withholding is. There were no timelines and no constructive rules of engagement, if you will. So we worked with the manufacturer on establishing some timelines and some clear guidelines on when a franchise can be sold and under what rules it can be sold. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about the bill.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Seems that a lot of work has gone into this, and you've got everybody either on board or neutral.
Yeah, there is no, Mr. Chairman, there is no known opposition to the bill in the building, and said the Tom Gallagher represents an alliance of manufacturers. I believe there's 11 different manufacturers, both foreign and domestic, that are part of that alliance that he negotiated on behalf of. Larry Campbell represents General Motors. Three of us met with our attorneys and other interested parties on too many occasions to account, and spent too many hours than any of us want to admit negotiating the fine points of this legislation. But we were able to do so to an agreement which brings the bill to you without opposition.
Thank you very much. The support on the House.
There were no votes. If I recall correctly, it was one of those evening sessions when other things were going on. I believe the vote was 41-0 with the rest of the members excused.
Thank you very much. There's no question. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2735, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2001. Elaine Seelock and Lynn Newkirk, please. And Speaker Snodgrass.
I apologize for being late.
All right. We just opened the hearing on April 2001.
Has it been described?
It has not.
Okay, do you want to do that before we start? That would be fine.
Describe the bill, please.
House Bill 2001 directs the Secretary of State to establish a computer-based centralized election registration system by January 1st, 2002. That is the biggest portion of this bill. The bill also limits voters' pamphlet arguments to material which is substantially related to the measure being addressed. It allows county clerks to open return identification and secrecy envelopes of mail ballots prior to the date of election. It directs county clerks at polling place elections to identify in poll books persons who applied for absentee ballots in an attempt to cut down on multiple voting. It requires county clerks to maintain a specified number of voting booths at certain mail elections. It prohibits the sale or purchase of ballots. It also modifies the date for mailing absentee ballots. And this bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. It also has conflict amendments, which are the -A7 amendments.
Thank you, Senator Starr and Senator Courtney, very much for being here today. I know that 8 o'clock in the morning is a tough time, obviously. I appreciate the opportunity that I've had to work with Representative Edwards on this issue. For the record, my name is Glenn Sondra. I'm the state representative from District 10. The Voter Protection Act, House Bill 2001 that you have before you, is some continuation of the hard work that we did last session to guarantee one person, one vote. What you have before you, I believe, is not necessarily a compromise, but rather a direction that we would like the state of Oregon to take under its current vote-by-mail election process. What we are attempting to do in here is to make sure that our voting records are accurate. And by accurate, I mean that we will combine the information from districts, from county and county, to make sure that, for instance, Lynn Snodgrass, that's married to Drake Snodgrass, is only registered to vote once and not in 3 or 4 different counties or 3 and 4 different precincts under different spellings, et cetera. So we are attempting to make a statewide voter registration system so that when the ballots are mailed, I will only receive one ballot to my home for me and not multiple ballots. So accuracy is obviously very important to us. Efficiency is important also, and we are trying in this bill to make sure that the county clerks have the ability to do their work in an efficient manner so that they can prepare the ballots to be read on election day in a more expeditious manner. Again, keeping the secrecy elements that they have to the high degree that it needs. We are also concerned about the privacy issue. I continue to be concerned that there will be homes that will have an atmosphere where the privacy issue will not be present anymore. For someone to be able to vote their conscience and not their spouse's conscience or an organization's conscience. And so what we've tried to do in this bill is allow for those kinds of opportunities so that there's enough voting booths within the state for people to still go and vote in private without breaking the trust of the voters of a vote-by-mail situation, but rather giving opportunities for those people that need privacy, the ability to have that privacy. The integrity of the ballot is important, and you will find that in the bill also. When I was, for the record, for those of you that don't remember, I was opposed to vote by mail, still continue to be opposed to vote by mail. However, it is lost, and I am trying to make it work. And one of the issues that was a great concern to me was the situation in Kentucky that was written about in many articles, where in Kentucky, their ballots are actually a cash crop, where people can and do, on record, sell their ballots. They sign the secrecy envelope, but then they hand the guts of that envelope to someone for a price. And $50 was the going price 4 years ago in Kentucky. And the person that paid for that ballot could then fill it out however they wanted to. I find that an abomination. personally, and I don't want that to happen in our state. And so as a deterrent, there is something in this bill that addresses that potential, that it's not only illegal to sell your ballot, but it's also illegal to buy a ballot. And we put it in as a Class C felony. Now, I don't believe that we're going to have ballot checking police patrol every place, but I do want us to make the statement that it is illegal and that we do continue to hold voting to the high degree that we do hold it. And with that, I would like to, if you don't mind, Chairman, to let Representative Edwards speak. Again, I appreciate all of the hard work that he did on this particular bill. In chairing the work group and coming up with many of the fine ideas that are on there.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Good morning, committee. My name is Randall Edwards, State Representative from House District 15 in Southeast Portland, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come here today to advocate for a bill that I think is much needed, and the ability to work with the Speaker and her staff on this bill as well. And I think what's critical about House Bill 2001 is we're looking at trying to prevent election fraud and improve citizen participation in Oregon's political process. Personally, I feel elections are a critical part of our democracy, and voting is a wonderful right that we all enjoy. When we make changes to our election system, it can have a profound impact and have implications on how we function as a society. So when we do change that system, we should not make light of that change. House Bill 2001, I believe, brings some needed changes to our election laws. Many of these changes are driven by the fact that we have embarked into uncharted waters by conducting all of our elections by mail. Thus, the challenge for us as lawmakers is to ensure that we make every effort to protect the voters from potential abuses and protect the sanctity of the ballot under an all-mail system. Maintaining accurate addresses for registered voters has gained greater importance under an all-mail voting system. With hundreds of thousands of ballots being sent out, inevitably a greater number of ballots will go to the wrong addresses. This raises the potential for ballots to be misused. Under the old system, ballots were better controlled since voters had to come to a polling place to receive their ballot and sign for that ballot. As was described by staff, the centerpiece of this bill is the establishment of a computerized statewide voter registration system to replace the current county-by-county registration system. The new voter registration file must be completed by January 1, 2002. Without a statewide voter roll, the potential exists for people to register and vote in more than one county, as described by the speaker. We want to make sure that there are protections in place to prevent voter fraud. This gives the counties the opportunity to talk to each other and eliminate mistakes and duplications. Further, we also added voting booths in this law and required that there be a number of polling places for folks. This will not replace ballot box drop-offs, but will give those who feel more comfortable in the privacy of the public, as odd as that may sound, to cast their ballot. Again, the speaker highlighted some of the major points about what the bill does: improves efficiency, guaranteed privacy, increases, we believe, the integrity of the ballot, and keeps voters informed. This bill has the support of the Secretary of State and passed wholeheartedly by the House recently, and we would encourage you to support the bill here and pass it on to Ways and Means so we can fund it and send it out.
Questions?
Hey, Senator Courtney, I noticed that on page 3, it says no sooner than the fifth day before the date of an election, in preparation for counting ballots ordered by mail, the county clerk may begin opening return mail ballots. And then the county clerk may take any other action that necessary to allow the counting ballots ordered by mail to begin an election day. So what you plan to do here is to allow them to open the ballots 5 days out, but they can't count them until election day. Why are you doing that? Why aren't you, if you're going to let them open them for purposes, for example, of a statewide election, why don't you start allowing the count to start the same day they open them?
Senator Courtney, Chair, to start, it's my opinion that we should continue to have an election day. And if there are counting of ballots prior to the election day, there's also the possibility that you would have results prior to the election day. And it's my feeling that that would be a disservice to Oregonians. You open the door for part of that, and you've opened the door to all of us. What I was trying to do, what Randall was trying to do, I believe, is to make the labor more efficient, the opportunity for labor to be more efficient within the county clerk's confines. So they do have a spatial problem. There's a lot of problems that they need to deal with in just their own little compartment in Multnomah County or Clackamas County, wherever. And they need to have some ability to use their labor force and the space that they have available more efficiently, and that would help. But the counting, the actual counting of them, opens up another avenue of potential disservice.
Well, then they can start counting them on election day at any time. They don't have to wait to 8 o'clock at night when the polls close.
According to this bill, that is an accurate statement.
Okay. When you say multiple ballots, you mean like, if we get one ballot now for state elections, you're saying like if at the same time there was a May or a November election and there was a local measure, you wouldn't get a separate ballot for a Marion County issue or a city's issue. Is that what you mean by one ballot? I don't quite know what you mean by one ballot.
Thank you for asking that question, Senator Courtney. Right now, I could get 3 ballots if I registered in 3 different counties. I could get 3 ballots for statewide, whatever the ballots were for, I could get 3 of them by going from county to county and having a post office box, which now typically they have numbers, addresses, rather than post office boxes. But I could get 3 separate ballots in 3 separate counties arrive at my home. And that's because the counties don't have the mechanism, a good mechanism to talk to each other, to let each other know that Lynn Snodgrass is registered at 3 different places. They don't talk to each other over county lines that way efficiently. In fact, in some cases, you could be registered in multiple precincts within your own county and get 3 different ballots.
Okay, but I was talking to my situation. I'm actually only in Sacramento County. I still, under your bill, could get more than one ballot. Is that right? More than one voter's pamphlet. I could get more than one voter's pamphlet. Is that right?
You'll get your county voter's pamphlet and your state voter's pamphlet.
But only one ballot.
Oh, no.
If you're registered one time, Senator, you will only get one ballot. That's correct.
Affecting all issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the argument, can I just decide, obviously, in a second. The argument shall be limited to material that substantially relates to the measure.
Mm-hmm.
The Secretary of State makes that decision. If you submit an argument, who makes that decision as to whether or not it substantially relates? Who's going to make that judgment call?
Thank you.
See you.
And actually, Colleen will be able to address that more specifically, but it would be complaint-driven. What we had was a case, and it happens more often than not now, Senator, where people would use the voter's pamphlet for their own cause, but have one line about a particular issue, and then the rest of the space they've used for their own cause. And to be perfectly honest, one of the things that was brought to light last session was a ballot measure that, if you read the voter pamphlet statements, you would think it was about vote by mail rather than about the measure itself.
Right.
And what we were trying to do is refocus people's ability to use the voter's pamphlet for their own cause and matter for the issue itself. That's what we were trying to attempt to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions?
No.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you bringing this.
Thank you, Senator Starr.
Now we will again call Colleen. Glenn Newkirk.
Good morning, committee. For the record, my name is Colleen Seelock. I'm the Director of Elections for the State of Oregon. And with me this morning is Glenn Newkirk. He is the Chief Executive Officer with InfoCentra. InfoCentra was contracted by the Secretary of State to complete a study on centralized voter registration. I believe you all received a copy of that. taken a rather thick book like this. We've given you the shortened version that we did give to the legislators who are not sitting on the Rules and Elections Committee. That shortened version is merely the first half of the more lengthy report. Glenn also was hired by the Federal Election Commission several years ago to produce a study that looked at other states, and this was given to you early in the session, so he is the author and is nationally recognized. Just a couple of things I want to address on the bill, and then I will ask Glenn to speak very briefly. We have the ability, if people would like to meet with Mr. Newkirk, and several have taken advantage, if you just give me a call, we can arrange for him to meet you in your office and maybe go over some of the questions and concerns with regard to that report later on. The two things I wanted to address that came from the earlier discussion is Representative Edwards referred to the booths that are created in 2001 as polling places. We would not refer to them as polling places. It's just a correction. In election jargon, a polling place would actually issue you a ballot. These booths in privacy locations will not be issuing ballots. You must bring your ballot from home. The only polling places that will occur in the future is at the clerk's office. Anybody can walk into the clerk's office. They have the ability to issue ballots. And so we will retain that, but only within the clerk's office. Senator Courtney asked some questions about counting ballots earlier. Right now, in every vote-by-mail election, we begin processing the ballots 5 days earlier. We have done that from the beginning in 1981 when it was an experiment so that the counting actually does occur quicker on election day. We would be opposed to counting ballots earlier. We believe very strongly that the day of the election is the day that you should properly count them. What this bill does is just put into statute a current existing rule that allows clerks to do the processing the 5 days earlier. The only other section of the bill that I wanted to make sure that this committee was aware of is a section that was very controversial in the House, and the clerks and the Secretary of State's office with the working group from the House committee worked long and hard to come to an agreement on it, and that is in Section 15, subsection 3, the exact line. It's on page 4, line 34. Where they have shortened the voting, the mail-out window. Currently, under our existing law, the window is 20 days to 14 days. For purposes of state election, we have always used the 20th to the 18th day, so that you're aware that's a Wednesday through Friday in a week. We've worked with them. We've reduced that window because we know that there is some concern among potential candidates and citizens about how long they have the ballot in place. So we've reduced that now to the 18th day, to the 14th day. So I just want to make sure that that's on the record and that you know that's in the bill. That is something that both look at. I believe I can speak for the clerk's organization that they're supportive of, as well as the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry to bother.
Colleen, can you talk a little bit about why that timeline, why not faster?
Well, for the difficulty we have with mailing out ballots is twofold. Number one is to mail the ballots out all over the state using the Postal Service in a way that the Postal Service can handle the mailing of ballots, because that is an extraordinarily heavy load for them to carry. As well as to achieve the ability that the voter can turn around and mail them back and still be assured that their ballot is going to be returned. The discussion primarily took place in the House. They initially thought maybe shortening it to the 15th day. Please keep in mind the 16th and 17th day of that window fall on Saturday and Sunday. We cannot mail on those 2 days, because we mail using a bulk rate, allows us to mail for about 7 cents a ballot, and they are delivered with the speed and expediency that the post office can deliver them is almost like first-class mail. If we wait and mail them on the 15th day, which is a Monday, it so shortens the window that we're very concerned about the way the mail delivery is run in this state. They invited a gentleman from the Portland Regional Post Office who understands the mailing systems throughout the state to help them work on this. all of the state mail goes to 5 or 6 regional post offices. So if you mail in Dallas, Oregon, your mail is going to come into Salem to be sorted and go back to Dallas. That's a relatively short trip. If you mail in the Dalles, well, your mail comes into Portland and goes back to the Dalles. And so to take advantage of as much time as possible, we were able to work through with everyone and say, we can do it on the 18th. That's probably when most of the mailing will occur, because we can mail on Friday. The post office then has the entire weekend to process that mail, get it in and out of the regional post office centers, and so the deliveries can start on the 15th and 14th day.
I guess another question that I have with regard to that, who is centralizing the voter registration process?
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would they even deal with the county clerks?
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, because the clerks are the ones that mail all the ballots. The Secretary of State's office will never mail ballots.
Why?
Well, it probably would become a very local issue. That is, one of their primary functions is to mail ballots, count ballots. That is the election function that we've always given to local officials.
But if you're doing it out of, if you could file centralized, why wouldn't you just do it centralized?
Sheriff Starr, Senator Beyer, because almost, I would say, about 95% of our elections include local matters, to which it would mean that our office would be having to do to print ballots based on the entire elections conducted within the state. It would be a Herculean effort, and one in which I, speaking off the cuff, not having talked directly to the Secretary of State, one in which I believe we would be opposed. The mail window really is not affected by the centralized voter registration system, other than it gives us more accurate data to do the mailing. But we do not see a connection between the mailing window and centralized voter registration.
So we'll, even under this concept, we'll still be mailing all the separate, or still be dealing with all the separate ballots and different kinds?
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, that would be correct.
So we really don't gain by going centralized. One of the things that I was hoping by doing this, we would centralize the computer systems. Some of the record keeping in some of the counties is pretty Byzantine because of financial constraints, I assume. Yeah.
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, we will be effectively producing a more accurate voter history. We'll be effectively producing candidate walking lists and watching where those voters move. But with respect to actually issuing the ballots, all you're really doing from the voter registration system is downloading the ballots. I mean, it is a key component, but we do not see it impacting the mailing window specifically. We do think it will give you a more accurate basis in which you can mail ballots out. We would agree that in those places where we do have some duplication of voters because they either did not completely fill out a new voter registration card when they moved, that we'll be able to detect those much easier under centralized voter registration system. Impact the window. And Senator Beyer, maybe futuristically, after we have centralized voter registration in place, and we see the work that it does, maybe you're seeing more into the future than what my limited vision allows me. But right now, we really don't see it impacting the
voter. How do you get the voter information in terms of whether they voted or not if you're doing the counting of the counties on
different
kinds of processes? How are you going to tie the two records together?
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, currently right now, every time someone votes, the clerk must go back in and enter into the fact, make a note in the file, in the voter registration file or the voter activity file, that that person voted. Your earlier comment about visiting procedures in some of the more rural counties, oftentimes that's nothing more than pulling up the voter registration card and make a tick mark. In the more sophisticated counties, that's all done on their automated database so that if you're in Multnomah County, Marion County, Lane County, you can go in and actually get a walking list that will tell you when that voter voted. Under the centralized voter registration system, we will be upgrading and making uniform the voter registration systems throughout the state and their ability to capture that same data on the same database in all 36 counties. And so if you're in some of the smaller counties, Sherman, Wheeler, Lake, you will get the same document as if you were in Multnomah County.
So to do that, it sounds like, if I may, Mr. Holmes, they will, in fact, you will be, if you centralize it, the Secretary of State's system will drive what the counties have to have.
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, yes. However, we're working very closely with the counties. I don't want anyone to misunderstand that this is a state system being imposed on the counties. I think we've all learned that that's not the way to go to create an effective system. Part of Glenn's time was spent driving through the entire state of Oregon and meeting with clerks in locations. We are not anticipating that the Secretary of State's office is going to do voter registration. Every county will continue to do voter registration. When they sit down to do voter registration, instead of sitting down at their own computer, they will be sitting down either at their own computer that's going to speak to our state computer and synthesize that information, or in some of the more rural counties, they will actually be sitting down at a computer the state will provide them, so that when they enter a registrant into that database, it will go into a centralized database. It will flag for people, oh, Colleen Seelock. There's another Colleen Seelock in the system. Now, the computer itself is not going to delete one. It is going to cause a red flag to go to both counties, the new county where we're entering information, the county, the original county where I may have been previously registered, and instruct them to check to see if this is an identical person or if I have a twin evil sister somewhere. Or maybe it's a good sister somewhere. to make sure that we aren't inadvertently deleting someone when the names are identical. So all of that work will still be done by the county. And that's one of the reasons, even though it is an expensive system, it's one of the ways that we're keeping the expense down.
So it'll be a common database.
It will be a common database shared by the state. And it will be uniform so that you as a candidate, if you move or if you decide to enter a statewide race when previously you were just running for senator rep, you will get the same information then from 36 counties instead of a hodgepodge, which you now receive.
In system sense, when they, take beyond the registration, when they're putting the voting information history in, they will have to be entering it into the state database. And I assume that those that are using electronic counting and whatever programs they're using in language will have to feed right in.
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, the vote tally system does not have to feed into the voter registration system because the vote tally system doesn't take Colleen Seelock's ballot and say, oh.
I understand.
And so what we're doing is just voter activity.
It would be a little duplicative if you didn't have that to have to enter the information twice.
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, I know this is difficult. I may not be explaining it properly. The five-day earlier window when we do the processing of the ballot, and your ballot is still contained in the outside envelope,
mm-hmm.
and we look up and we see Colleen Seelock, they will be entering on the voter registration system. Oh, there's Colleen Seelock's ballot. It's checked. Okay, that's in the voter registration system that is keyed into the voter activity system. Later in the day or the next day, the outside envelope is going to be shipped off into a secure area because we keep those as the polling book. The secrecy envelope is then later opened. The ballot is inspected. It is then counted by the vote tally system, which this basically does count. So those systems do not necessarily have to be linked, but clearly the voter registration and voter activity systems need to be one and the same.
The only problem is to come up with more secrecy envelopes for people who have voted and have votes. More.
Chair Starr, if I might, I'd like to introduce Glenn Newkirk to just speak very briefly and, again, would offer people the opportunity to contact me if you have additional questions because he will be available through the end of the week.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee staff. I think you see from the discussion so far,
identify yourself.
My name is Glenn Newkirk, President of InfoCentury Services, who has worked under contract with the Secretary of State's office on the statewide voter registration study. I think you will see from the immediately preceding discussion that we had a tremendous advantage of being able to work with she would admit it or not. This is a systems analysis level work you just heard. And we also got that from the 36
counties and the people there. They were the ones who were telling us what was needed and the functions that this system should perform. As Colleen said, we conducted a number of focus groups throughout the state. 27 county clerks participated. We surveyed twice all of the counties, and we conducted site visits in 15 of the counties, where we pretty much followed voter registration documents as they went through their system. And Senator Beyer, it was very interesting all the way through it to be able to follow exactly how they handled all of these records. That was most interesting, and we did it. And it was a pleasure to be able to go and visit all the counties that we did. We also had benefit of an advisory board made up of staff from the Secretary of State's office, from county clerk, representatives of both major political parties and other political parties. A member of the media participated on it from the point of view of their research needs. So we believe that we have attempted to be very inclusive of all of the stakeholders involved in a central voter registration system for Oregon. Basically, we found from the comments that there were a number of advantages and needs identified from an Oregon central voter registration system. The first one you have already heard from the speaker clearly is the reduction in the potential for duplicate and multiple registrations. That was a key element, and also a reduction goes with that in the potential of being able to vote more than once. We also heard a number of comments from county clerks, and I think this was probably one that was consistent throughout all of our focus groups and interviews, was that a step like this of creating this kind of a system that would work toward ensuring timely and accurate files in all the counties would increase the voter confidence that the system really is working. We had a lot of comments that people would say, well, I've had people come to me and say that they've registered to vote 5 times in the past 2 months as they just moved into the state from someplace, and what's going on here? How come we can register so many times? And so this would be a step that would demonstrate to the citizens that actions are being taken to be sure that they, in fact, are registered accurately and timely in one place. Another issue that was an important advantage mentioned in our surveys and the focus groups was the possible avoidance of the double majority lawsuits. Because elections are so close, the numbers become very important in the requirement to get out the 50% of the registered voters. Therefore, the list needs to be clean for that purpose as well. Another issue was the one-stop shopping for a clean voter list. I think Colleen has already discussed that. Another one, and I believe, Senator Beyer, you were touching on this as well, is the efficiency and cost savings that would be brought about by a system. It costs a lot of money to mail election materials, ballots, to the degree that you can prevent, as the speaker said, one person getting 3 ballots, you are reducing the cost of them to the counties of election administration. There is another advantage, and I think this one goes to address something that Senator Beyer talked about, and that is without a system like this, all of these kinds of things that you are interested potentially in looking at would simply be impossible without having a statewide network in place to carry out that kind of electronic file transfer. Primary disadvantage listed, cost. Very clear, counties were very attuned to the fact that you don't go from systems which in one county they are maintaining their voter registration system at this point on a spreadsheet. To go from that to a timely, accurate, statewide network in which all this information is flowing, and when something occurs in a county, it is registered within a day in the statewide voter file. That simply costs money to create that infrastructure, and the counties were very aware of that. That was no surprise to them. We we were required under our contract to come up with essentially three alternatives, three options. We came up with five potential options, and give a computer person an inch and they'll take a mile. So we believe it's very important to do that because it's a serious matter. It's spending public money, and it's protecting essentially a constitutional right of voting. And therefore, we wanted to come up with realistic alternatives that would offer varying levels of risk for implementation. Putting in a computer system is not a risk-free effort. You have a lot of elections in Oregon, and putting in a new system of any kind that deals with that is like changing tires on a moving car. You can't stop elections for a couple of years while you put in a new system. There inevitably is risk involved. So the effort is, how can you contain the risk? And so we looked at what are the risk factors of the alternatives. The cost ranged from approximately $3.9 million on one alternative to approximately $8.5 million on another alternative. The one that we've recommended was approximately $5.9 million. We believe that that one gives the not only the best balance of function and risk, when you weigh all of those together, it also provides, I believe, a more maintainable computer platform over a long period of time. I don't think I've told Colleen this, but in 1964, Professor Peter Drucker did a study for the Department of Defense on cost of tanks. And if you'd like to take a wild guess, is what is the largest cost element of a tank over a 20-year life period? It's training. And after that is design and engineering. And you go way down the list before you get to the hardware and the manufacturing and transportation of the tank. So the key element is to put a system in early, which frequently will cost more money to do it that way up front. But it gives you the ability to maintain the system at a lower cost over a 5, 10, 15-year life cycle of that entire computer system. We believe that the alternative we recommended, not the most expensive, not the least expensive, is the one that provides that best combination for Oregon over the life cycle of the system. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that concludes essentially the prepared remarks I had. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Next question.
Putting a line on page 326. For elections not conducted by mail. I thought all elections were going to be conducted by mail.
Chair Starr, Senator Courtney, the local elections are still permissive for the clerk to choose. Historically, for the last probably 4 or 5 years, they've all been conducted vote by mail, but we still need to retain that option for local elections. The primary and general now must be conducted using vote by mail.
Okay, and lines, page 4, section 14, the Secretary of State and Attorney General shall investigate any alleged violation. Secretary of State or the Attorney General receives a complaint. The complaint is filed with Secretary of State and Attorney General after blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyer in it tells me that's sort of awkward. I mean, why wouldn't it be one venue as opposed to either or? It's like, you file the AG, do they do the same thing that the Secretary of State does? Or you file the AG, you don't like what you hear, so then you go file the Secretary of State. It's like you can file in circuit court or you can file in the Court of Appeals, which isn't correct. I mean, I don't understand why either or as opposed to the complaint should be handled by the AG or the Secretary of State should receive the complaint immediately handed over to the AG investigation. What's this Secretary of State or Attorney General thing?
Chair Starr, Senator Courtney, I believe the speaker was concerned that on occasion it may be more appropriate to file a complaint with the Attorney General, given maybe policy or political positions of the Secretary of State. And I believe that's the reason that you have two different venues in which you could file that complaint. if it, we oftentimes, as many of you know, before we take action that imposes a penalty, we always review those cases with the Attorney General's office, just as a good precursor to make sure that we're on good legal footing. But I believe that that's the reason that that language is drafted in that way.
What do you stand for, Ms. Harden?
Are you looking off the Ian Gross bill? I'm having trouble following you.
Yeah.
Sure, Senator Clinton, it is.
It's on the bottom of page 2, section 10, and continues on page 3. So the same language.
So two separate venues.
That's correct.
Interesting. Okay. Further questions, Senator Park?
Glenn, your experience in other states, and I guess I'm assuming you have quite a bit of familiarity with the law. One of the problems is trying to figure out whether, you know, Mary Smith in one county is the same as Mary Smith and Mary A. Smith in another county. How have people dealt with that, and is there the potential there to use the Social Security numbers, or is that prohibited?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that is probably one of the most difficult technical tasks that you end up addressing in building a system like this. In our recommendations, which came from what the county clerks suggested, there needs to be additional information added to that that's already collected. There are obvious concerns and legal prohibitions against just using the Social Security number. However, there is the potential of using, collecting additional information as mandatory, which again would require statutory change, such as the birth date, and then collecting perhaps a portion of the Social Security number, which other states have moved toward the last four digits.
Is that an identifier?
I'm sorry?
Is that an identifier then?
It would allow you to build, if you added, and there's a technical way of designing databases where you would take perhaps the first four characters of the last name, the birth date, and then the last four digits of the Social Security number, and while it's not a, it doesn't really allow you to pinpoint an exact person at an exact place necessarily, if those same identifiers pop up in the course of a duplicate search, then that gives, as Colleen indicated, that throws up at least yellow flags to notify the people in the counties that they have potentially the same person. You have one great advantage that many other states do not have. You already have a large number of counties who collect digitized signatures.
Mm-hmm.
If those signatures were also in a statewide voter registration system, when those flags came up, it would make it much easier and much quicker then to identify if that is the same Mary Smith that is registered in two counties. We found a great deal of support in the counties for looking very seriously at adding additional information to the limited information you already collect, precisely to help in that kind of a situation.
So let me be real clear. Am I correct in understanding that you cannot use the Social Security, the full Social Security number, prohibited by federal law?
Yes.
Okay, but it's not prohibited to use a portion of the number?
Correct.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Byer, just quickly, I would add to that. There's another legislative session that will occur prior to the implementation. The federal government is also looking right now whether Social Security numbers can be used for election-related matters. And so we have not introduced any bill dealing with Social Security numbers yet. But we would anticipate that in the 2001 session.
We are pushing the opportunity to move this bill today because we're fixed to lose that member. You need to pursue this line of questioning, or can you visit with Mr. Newkirk a later time?
I guess it gets to where I was getting to is cost. It doesn't make any sense to me to move the bill unless the legislature, and I suppose I'm asking, this committee is willing to foot the bill to implement it. It doesn't, it isn't going to work if the legislature doesn't pay for it. So the real question is going to be, is the legislature up to the tune of
I know the number was 5 or 7, but probably $10 to $20 million. That's the real issue when you get down, because you're going to have to, I mean, realistically, if you want this thing to work, you're going to have to buy most of the equipment in the counties. They won't have the technical capability to do it. I know we can always talk about band-aiding this together, but the reality is it ain't going to work unless you have equipment that at least at the start talks to each other well and isn't band-aided together.
Is the bill going the ways it means?
The bill is going from here to ways it means, and I think unless we move it to ways it means...
Before it goes to the floor?
Yes. Unless we move it to ways it means, we'll get further hearings. We are not in work session at the moment, and I do have another witness. Kathy Eaton has signed up to testify. Kathy, can you just tell us that you're in favor of doing this and let us go on?
I can do that.
Unless you're not.
I'm just kind of members of the committee. The League of Women Voters studied this rather extensively over a year's time, a couple of years ago. And one of the primary points that we talked about was a centralized election system. Our voter registration needs to be protected, and it needs to be efficient, and it needs to be can be used to validate our process. We also found that the communications between county clerks was dismal, and this was one way to improve that and to make it all one system. So, yes, we are very much in favor of it, and Senators Star, Senator Beyer, the League is certainly willing to speak at the appropriate time to Ways and Means about the importance of funding this particular process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So then I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on the House Bill 2001.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2001.
We need to move the -7 amendments, and the administrators explained that those were...
These are conflict amendments to resolve conflict.
Technical conflict amendments.
I move the House amendment the -7 amendments for 2001 as amended.
Senator Courtney has moved the H-87 amendments to House Bill 2001. Any objection? For
order. Chair, I move House Bill 2001 A and goes as amended to the Raising Ways and Means recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved the amended House Bill 2001 A and gross to Ways and Means. The do pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Yes.
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator
Aye. I receive the necessary majority. Senate Bill, or House Bill 2001, engrossed has moved to Ways and Means with a due pass.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Is it appropriate for us to perhaps send a love note along with it down to Ways and Means and say, don't throw this bill out unless you fund it? And we have a bad habit of doing that in the Assembly, and I think it just makes absolutely no sense to move forward unless we're willing to fund it.
Appreciate that, and I think that we need to be watchful in the process if that doesn't happen. I'm going to now, since I have a representative here wanting to testify. We have had a hearing on House Bill 2735. I'd like to move that in.
Sure. I'm going to work professional. I move House Bill 2735. Is that amended or not?
That is, it has no amendments.
So, to the floor of the DuPage recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved House Bill 2735 to the floor of the DuPage recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator
Yes.
Senator
Aye. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2735 moves to the floor of the DuPage recommendation. Carrier.
He moved it.
Oh, I'm not sure. Senator Courtney will pray. Thank you.
I may be going to short while.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2828 and call Representative Crump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Cuff, State Representative, District 37, and I have before you a very simple bill, which I have entitled the Classroom Accountability Act, formerly known as the Spanking Bill, which is no longer a spanking bill because it's been neutered. Basically, what this bill does, very simply, is codifying the statute that school districts need to provide a written disciplinary policy to parents and legal guardians. They enforce the policy, and if they do so, they are held harmless. They are granted civil immunity from lawsuit if they enforce the terms of that written disciplinary policy. However, if they step outside of that policy, they are a fair game, as they are now in many ways. Why do we need a bill like this? Well, I think that in my experience of being a fire prevention teacher in third and fourth grade, which I have done the last several years, going once a month for 30 minutes and teach fire prevention to third and fourth graders, in moderate classroom sizes, 22, 26 kids is the most I've ever had, I personally observed that when you have some children who are perhaps a bit hyperactive, perhaps have not been taught the proper respect for authority from home, it is very, very difficult to be able to effectively communicate the message that you're trying to communicate. And I have great sympathy for teachers who face this every day in their classrooms. And I've heard from a lot of teachers who face this issue consistently and are very concerned that they do not control classrooms anymore and that children know it. And thereby, I believe that it was important that we give teachers and administrators and school bus drivers, for that matter, the legal authority to be able to enforce whatever appropriate discipline that a school district feels is proper and correct. I'd like to call your attention to a Supreme Court ruling a couple of days ago where the Supreme Court ruling said that in a 5-4 decision that the case in Georgia, that a school district, in fact, did not take appropriate remedial action against a fifth-grade boy who was sexually harassing a fifth-grade girl. And this kind of thing goes on all the time. You get bullying in schoolyards and on school buses. You get inappropriate behavior that is not being, in my view, in some cases, and it's really a case-by-case and school-district-by-school-district, school-by-school basis, some cases is not being taken care of appropriately. Those children are not being shown, especially at an early age, that there are inappropriate behaviors and that they will be held accountable for them. We need to let them know. Parents always are the primary factor in this issue, in my view, but because I think we all recognize that we've had a certain societal breakdown of the nuclear family and that some parents do not teach their children proper respect for authority, or in some cases are unable to because of perhaps addictions to alcohol and drug abuse. This is a rampant issue, especially in the elementary schools. So this bill is designed to keep these kinds of Supreme Court decisions from occurring because, in my view, had this bill been enforced in Georgia, they would have had to enforce disciplinary actions against this young man who was continually, as the story goes, exhibiting inappropriate behavior towards this girl. And that's why we need to do this, more than anything. There is, because we have not had this codified in the law to the extent that we're talking about today, we have had school districts that I believe have, again on a case-by-case basis, have adopted some policies that I think are ineffective. Let me give you an example. A school district not far from where I live, as an example, has a policy in their junior high school, and I know this because my cousin teaches seventh grade there, and she is very frustrated over this issue. If she wants to put a child in detention, she has to call the child's parents first and then schedule the detention around the child's schedule. And what's frustrating to her is that sometimes, especially it doesn't work, because sometimes she can't put that child in detention for a week. And it's totally ineffective. And that's why, and again, that's an extreme example, but again, the message that has come clearly to me time and time again from not only administrators, but absolutely teachers who are in the trenches every day, is that they don't feel they can control their classes. They're afraid to.
because they think they're going to be sued. That possibility is always out there. We want to take that fear away from them. We had a lot of testimony on this bill. Many of the individuals testifying were testifying against the issue of corporal punishment, which was originally in the bill, has been removed and amended out of the bill. And we very specifically define what the intention of the legislation is. In Section 1, Section 2 talks about, includes these ideas, but not limited to these ideas in terms of work punishment, physical punishment, detention, suspension, expulsion. Define school employees as a broad term that under the current statute allows basically anyone who is employed at the school district to have the authority to enforce discipline. And that is mostly meant specifically for school bus drivers, where there are some discipline issues that have arisen very clearly, and there are records of them. Again, the school district is directed to adopt a written disciplinary policy, and I don't know of a school district that doesn't already do this, but we're saying that we feel it's important that they do that so that if you are going to grant civil immunity, which is in the last section of the bill, parents' rights have to be respected, and they need to be notified in the beginning of the school year of what in the student handbook, what a school disciplinary policy is, so that they know full well right up front what the parameters are in regards to the discipline. Section 4 is a section that we added at the request of the teachers' union, which deals specifically with the aspect of a district is going to enforce the rules that they have written in their student code of conduct. And this is a result of, and Senator Beyer, you're very familiar with this, the Thurston shooting, that entire incident, is my understanding, and I hope that I'm relating this correctly, and perhaps you can correct me if I'm incorrect, was that previous to the shooting incident, another student a week or 2 weeks before had been actually expelled for bringing a weapon to school. And the young man in question of the shooting was not expelled, for whatever reasons I don't know, but at any rate, it was their disciplinary policy was not followed in the same manner. That's my understanding.
No, that's incorrect. They were both expelled.
They were both expelled? Kip Kinkle was expelled?
Was expelled. That probably, in that case, was the cause of the shooting.
Okay. And then my interpretation is incorrect. Thank you, Senator Beyer, for correcting me. And Section 5 basically, again, lays forth the concept of civil immunity from lawsuit, again, as long under those written disciplinary policy, as long as it's within the conformity of with the laws of the state and the rules established by the State Board of Education and the policy established by the school district, which clearly says if you step outside of that, if a teacher or anyone steps outside of that written disciplinary policy, then they've crossed the line that we're saying they shouldn't cross. I think it's very, very important that we do this. We talked with the School Boards Association. We made changes on their behalf. The Teachers Union, we made changes on their behalf. The School Administrators Association, and certainly parents. There is also one other aspect of Section 3 that I'd like to call your attention to, which is on line 23 of the first page. It says, every school district may adopt a parent accountability plan. This is an idea that was brought to me by the School Administrators Association. I think it's a great idea in that, and we're leaving the broad definition of that up to rulemaking or either to the individual school district. Well, basically the concept there is that if a child is showing himself to be a problem in terms of discipline time after time, that the school district can then work with the parents and come up with a plan, not only at school but also at home, to keep this, to move this child in a direction of respecting other children's rights, respecting authority, and trying to correct these issues that come forth in terms of disciplinary problems. And that is a great idea, and I think the school districts should be looking at that. It's my understanding some already have, and I would like to see that as a more statewide emphasis in that regard. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
I think you're on a good track here.
Thank you.
But I do have some questions.
Yes.
And, one of the issues, anytime you try to be very specific about something, rules of law, if you weren't specific, it's considered that that isn't part of the issue. Clearly, this one, you're attempting to protect school employees at whatever level. But is your intent that the school district, school board, could still be sued by a parent? Have you admitted that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, no, that is not the intention. Our intention is to hold harmless the teacher, the administrator, the school district, the school board, and any other school employee across the board. I don't think
you've done that.
Okay. Well, I am, Senator, I am more than happy to work with you in regards to specifically spelling that out. I had thought that we had taken care of that. Section 3 does imply, to an extent, the public school employees may utilize any type of discipline that has been authorized by the school district board. But Section 5 does, in regards to civil immunity, does say public school employees, and I don't think, and you may have a very good point, Senator, that the school board itself would not be considered school district employees.
I'm sure they aren't.
Yeah.
It's a legal entity. The other one is by very specifically adopting this. Are you giving parents who may feel that their child was harmed in some way by the lack of punishment, are you creating a cause of action for them?
Mr. Chair, Senator, would you take that question again. I want to make sure I'm understanding your thought there.
Okay. It's just an issue. If you're very clear in saying, and you say, thou shalt adopt a discipline plan and the board, the employees of the school district shall carry it out. If they don't carry it out and a child is harmed, have you created a cause of action for a parent of a child or for the child himself saying, I was harmed because the school district did not follow the law.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't administer in an acceptable way their own discipline plan.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, yes. And that is clearly the intent of the legislation is to, in fact, prevent this kind of a lawsuit right here in the Georgia case as a result of that not occurring. The school district, once they're given the civil immunity, I think would be looking at that very scenario if they did not enforce, and that is why we say in Section 4 that they shall enforce written disciplinary policy. And if, I mean, clearly then they would be in violation of the statute and should be open.
I mean, you kick the, when you get in with the teachers, that's clearly an open wound to them. In many cases, they
Absolutely.
Feel that the administration of the various school buildings
Yes.
are not being enforced fairly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that is a complaint I have heard very, very often.
Well, in any setting you sit on with teachers, you'll usually hear that. Unless they have an unusual principal. Even if the principal thinks they're doing a good job, there's always differences of opinion.
We, Senator Byer, we, and Mr. Chair, we inserted that language at their request. They had originally, the word uniformly was in there, and we deleted that particular word at the request of the, some individuals who were concerned about that particular word and its possible legal implication. And we felt that was a reasonable compromise, that we're still stating the intent of the legislation that, and we're still directing them that they shall enforce its written disciplinary policies. There is another bill that we have passed in the House, and I don't know if you have heard it or it was heard on the Senate side, that specifically dealt with this issue and used essentially the same language but did use the word uniformly. And so that is, it is perhaps a bit redundant, but we felt it important that we included that in this.
Well, you sort of do anyway. You've got it on, if you, on second page for the immunity in line for your talk, if the discipline is administered in conformity, that's the same thing as uniformity.
Thank you very much. I think that perhaps we should, before moving the bill, investigate our...
I'd say that
we should investigate.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, I think you bring forth a very, very good point, and I am somewhat embarrassed and remiss in acknowledging that I have missed that. I had thought that we had taken care of that, but I think that's a very, very good point.
School Boards Association, I mean, is anybody here from school boards?
No, I don't see
that.
No, apparently they've missed it also. And
it might be that they've looked at it and it's not an issue.
Well, I will check that with legislative counsel, and I will get back to the administrator immediately and also to you in regard to that. And if we need to amend that, I will get that process started immediately, as I would very much like to move this bill to the floor. But let's make sure we've done a good job with this bill before we do that.
I appreciate that. With that, I'm going to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Public hearing on House Bill 2828 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2576. Steve Shepard and Bruce. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. House Bill 2576 comes to you in its amended form from the House, where it passed 51-1, and I believe the remainder of the members were excused. I'm not aware of any opposition. I'm pleased to be joined this morning by Mr. Shaw of Sprint, and he will obviously show you Sprint's position on the bill himself. The bill deals with a problem that is the number one most commonly reported problem by a factor of almost three times over the next most frequently reported consumer complaint that our office receives in our work on behalf of Oregon consumers. And that's the problem that's known as slamming. And briefly described, that simply is the practice of switching a customer from one long-distance service provider, typically, to a different one without that consumer's clear and unambiguous consent to that change. We have received over 1,300 complaints in the last period for which I ran statistics, and I just brought with me a copy of the printout from our computer on those. There are 10 complaints on every page, and you can see the huge stack of things that are here. And I think that the first page of those is useful to note to the committee, because for every slam that injures a consumer, there is also a business victim, that is, the long-distance service company that had the customer in the first place. So each of these not only reflect a consumer complaint, but also a problem for the long-distance companies. And I think that's part of the reason that we enjoyed a very good process in the House, in which we had many meetings with representatives of those companies to develop the legislation that you have before you. The other thing that this first page illustrates, I think, well for the committee is that businesses are also the victims of slams. In fact, the very first complaint we have is from a business called Gino's Seafood and Deli. Now, I don't know where Gino's Seafood and Deli is, but they complained to our office about having their long-distance service switched from one company to another. So we deal here not merely with individual consumers who have been slammed, but also in some instances with businesses that have been the subject of these switches. Now, let me just mention very briefly three key features of the bill and tell you that the bill is overall designed to take the profit out of slamming, to take the incentive to engage in these practices out of slamming, and secondly, to do so in a way that maintains a fair and workable structure of rules and regulations for those long-distance service providers and also for local service providers who may do business in multiple jurisdictions. Now, the first feature, and really in a sense the core of the bill, is in Section 2.1. Little B, lines 15 to 19 on the first page of the bill.
And this is the provision of the bill that requires a company to obtain a separate, affirmative, unambiguous, and verified order for each change in the identity of the long-distance or local telephone service provider. The second provision of the bill that I wanted to point out to the committee is also on page 1, it's section 1. And what section 1 says is that if a consumer, an individual, or a business for that matter, is slammed, then the first 30 days of service provided by the company that commits the slam, we'll call them the slammer, that first 30 days of service by operation of law is deemed to be a gift from the slammer to the consumer. And this is really a core provision in removing the incentive to engage in this practice, because what it says to the business is, you can't profit from this. For that first 30 days of service, and 30 days was picked because we hope that consumers will be made aware in their next ensuing telephone bill of the fact that they've been switched from one company to another. You can't profit from that because we're deeming that, the state of Oregon is deeming that to be a gift. The third feature of the bill is on the second page, lines 21 through 25. And this is the provision of the bill that establishes a cause of action both for the Attorney General and for any person, and the term person is intended to include any entity, be it a business or a consumer, who has suffered some ascertainable loss as a result of slamming activity that violates the provisions of the statute. This section provides a cause of action to recover those damages, also to potentially recover attorney's fees and potentially recover punitive damages in the event that a jury were to award them. The bill also provides that in that judicial action there would be civil penalty authority of up to $1,000 per violation. Now, I want to note something in particular on line 22. The cause of action arises when a person, the slammer, engages in the willful use or employment of one of the practices that is prohibited under the law. Now, we use that term willful with the intention of making it clear that this is not a strict liability offense. That is, for the cause of action to arise, it's not enough simply to show that there was a slam. Rather, you have to show that the slam resulted from the willful use of some practice that's prohibited by the law. Now, willful has a particular meaning. We intended to borrow, by using that term, the definition that's in ORS 646-605 sub 10, which is the State's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the basic law, basic consumer protection law that's available in Oregon to consumers. That definition means that the person has to have engaged in the practice knowing that it was a violation of law, or having a reason to know that it was a violation of law. And there have been some cases that interpret that essentially to mean that there at least has to be some form of negligence in the activity. So it's not a strict liability violation of the statute that gives rise to the cause of action, but rather there at least has to be some kind of unreasonable conduct that a reasonable business would not have engaged in knowing what the law requires. So with that, I will leave myself open to questions from the committee and invite Mr. Shaw to state his principal position.
Senator Bayer.
Thank you, Mr. Pete. Question, you've left it up to the PUC to define standards of documentation. And there's some deference in here, sometimes, to federal law. I understand that. Does federal law preclude the state from requiring that change of service be made in writing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bayer, the relevant section to your question is Section 4. Section 4 statutorily provides two mechanisms by which adequate verification may be established under the to meet the requirements of the bill. The first one is, as you say, any manner provided by federal law, and the second would apply in lines 39 to 41 in the event there is no applicable federal law defining how to verify a change in customer service. The federal law, in our judgment, as a legal matter, would not prohibit the state from adopting a higher standard, a more rigorous standard for the change of one customer, of a customer from one long-distance telephone service provider to another. However, it is the intent of the bill to link Oregon standards to the federal law. And existing federal law and specifically rules that have been adopted and are now in partial effect by the Federal Communications Commission does allow verification by means other than the written consent of the consumer. This was a very important issue, I understand, and understandably so, for the other parties to the negotiations on this measure, because companies that do business in more than one jurisdiction are very anxious to have a rule that they can apply to customers in Boise as well as to customers in Ontario. So the answer to your question is, I think, as a legal matter, my judgment is that the federal rules and laws regarding flaming would not prohibit a state from having a higher standard. However, for purposes of this bill, this bill would establish for Oregon the requirement that Oregon's verification rules would move in lockstep with the federal rules.
Right, and I'll just throw out a comment, and maybe Bruce can address it or you, Pete. Having been slammed once at my residence and once in my business, I have a little familiarity with it. My sense is that I don't have any problem with competition, but I would feel best if, you know, and I think it's the language on the first page 18 and 19, if we required in part of that the confirmation be in writing, but there may be some technical reasons why that doesn't make sense.
Sure, I think Mr. Shaw can probably address the policy issues there.
I think, Bruce Shaw with Sprint, Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer. Confirmation business is somewhat unsettled at the FCC, maybe as you know at this point. Several companies have banded together to form a coalition that would suggest that there might be a third-party verification action that would occur. So if Sprint signed up a customer, then an independent third party would call that customer and say, Senator Beyer, have you agreed to be switched to Sprint? And
what would be the problem, Bruce, if you're just required written? I could see a process where, what I normally have encountered on telecommunications sales, not telephone, but other practices we do in sales, mm-hmm. you get a confirmation letter from somebody saying, this is what we've done, and it's real easy. It would be real easy, I would think, to have a perforated card that you could just sign and send it back and say, I've seen it, and this initiates the change.
I think and most long-distance carriers do send confirmation of a change.
Who the slam me didn't.
Yeah.
I was notified by the company of carriers that said, did you really intend to do this? And it was a month afterwards.
By whom?
The carrier. The carrier that I had no intention of being changed from.
Okay.
Said, we've been notified that you're changing service. What did we do wrong?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think as Pete mentioned, basically our desire is to make sure that we have a sort of a national policy across the board. We're willing to follow that, whatever it is. If that requires written confirmation, we would follow that. But if it, what we don't want to get into is a situation where an Oregon we have to remember to call you and write you and get something back before we change you, and in Idaho we're going some other way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why when we worked with Mr. Shepard in this regard, we would like to keep it to the federal standard, whatever that federal standard may be, as it evolves.
What is it now?
As I said, it's undergoing some challenge right now. There, some long-distance providers have suggested a third-party verification, and I know that the court recently struck down the filing rule for the SEC, or at least stayed them, I guess, would be a more accurate.
Senator Beyer, the current status of the rules adopted by the Federal Communications Commission, as I understand it, as of late last week, is simply this. The FCC had proposed, and in fact some portion of the rules had gone into effect, rules that would change in a wholesale way the way the Federal Communications Commission deals with slamming complaints. Among those changes were specifications for the procedure for verifying changes in consumer orders. In the FCC rules, as they were promulgated and ultimately adopted, third-party verification of some form, meaning some kind of an arm's length entity, not the slamming company itself, would have to contact the consumer or be in contact with the consumer in one way or another in order to verify the order and then to document the consumer's consent to an agreement to the change. The rules as adopted by the FCC weren't, there was an alternative proposed by an industry group to substitute for the FCC's notion of a third-party verification an entirely new entity, essentially a joint venture in the form that the industry proposed it, amongst various industry members, that would have the administrative responsibility for going out and verifying all of the change orders that consumers would place. That proposal from the industry, that's the proposal that Mr. Shaw was referring to, has not been adopted by the Federal Communications Commission. And in the midst of those discussions, a number, although not all, of the companies with an interest in this area filed a court action to stay the implementation of portions of the federal rules, particularly, as I understand it, the enforcement portions. So the federal rules right now, as they exist on the books, provide for the alternative of third-party verification, but do not yet adopt the provisions that Mr. Falls referred to in the form of an industry-funded separate entity that would handle the verification.
It would be like a trade group established call center?
As I understand it, it's some kind of, like I say, arm's length that the industry would put together that would be doing these verifications.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the National Association of Attorneys General has taken position in opposition to that proposal as it presently exists, and that is not part of the rules as they exist. The federal rules right now and the rules that Oregon would be required to follow if this bill became law would permit third-party verification, but would not adopt the idea of this third-party entity that would perform these administrative functions.
So it could be just, I mean, if I'm a XYZ company out of Houston, Texas, and I've got 15 different names, and we've all seen the articles in the paper, the trademark ways to slam somebody. Could I just create a third-party company to do that under the existing federal rules, or with the same third party, I'm assuming some appearance of independence, but I'm not seeing how you do that unless it was a...
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe the federal rules as they presently exist they were adopted with awareness of the problem that had existed previously in which companies asserted that they had third-party verification, mm-hmm. but in fact there was question about whether in fact those third-party verifications were reliable or not. So the rules as adopted by the FCC, as I understand it, do attempt to ensure that true third-party verification takes place. That is to say, you can't just pass the phone to the person at the next desk and get that person to behave as though they are the third-party administrator or the third-party verifier. In addition, the existing federal communication rules require a higher level of documentation, as I understand it, than previously had been required. So there have the federal communication rules, which the National Association of Attorneys General did support and do support, do improve the situation over the current over the previous arena in which there wasn't a clear requirement for third-party verification. They don't. The FCC rules do not go so far, and this bill would not require Oregon to go so far, however, as requiring only written verification or requiring necessarily a specific form of confirmation after the fact.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, Bruce Hollis Green, I'd just like to say that Mr. Shepard has been extremely forthcoming in seeking out input from the industry. We had two or three meetings on this particular bill and hammered out what is now before you. And for Sprint, we are agreeable with this bill, and I think we have a good bill here that both sides can live up to.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on 2576? Not going to close our public hearing on 2576 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2766. Ask Bill McKinley, John McCauley, and Dennis. Dennis not in the room. Dennis Mulvihill.
He was.
Was in the room, and now he's not. Okay, Margaret.
Hi,
thank you, Margaret.
Mr. Chairman, John McCauley representing Oregon Affairs Association. And I'll let Mr. Mulvihill explain a good part of the bill, but just to let you know that this bill comes to you after significant negotiations among the Oregon Affairs Association and the Association of Oregon Counties in the House, and agreements were reached over there. And as a result of the English version of House Bill 2766 supported by the Oregon Affairs Association, the bill establishes several changes in the law governing county fairs. It clarifies that the county commissioners may remove a fair board member for cause. It also provides that donations of property to a fairgrounds, it sets up a procedure for donating property to a fairground. There have been some disputes in the state over property that was intended to be used for the fairgrounds given by a family, and then the county commission decided they wanted to use that property for something other than fair. So it sets up a procedure to allow that to happen. And thirdly, it addresses the question of risk management on the part of the county commissioners for activities that occur on the fairground. The last part of the bill discusses how the county fair board and the county commissioners must meet and reach an agreement on how liability issues are to be addressed. Those are the main parts of the bill as it comes to you that have been agreed to by the two organizations. I will let Mr. Mulvihill and Mrs. Garza talk about another portion of this issue that is yet to be resolved, I think, with the Dash 5 amendments that you have. There is an agreement on those, but I'll let them describe that.
Good morning. Dennis Mulvihill, Washington County. I trust you have the A5 amendments in front of you. What they do, it provides for a process to abolish a fair board and to reconstitute that fair board into a fair association or a fair district. Now, to get to that takes a lot of public process. We've built in an extensive public process here. Before a county fair board and a county commission can even sit down and engage on this, they have to jointly appoint a citizens review committee three from each by each. If that committee comes back with a positive response that they think it's in the best interest of the citizens of that county, then the two bodies can proceed. It was a safety mechanism, frankly, put in there to really try to get the community more involved in it. Once that happens, then the two bodies can engage in a negotiation, and if they both come to an agreement on either setting up a fair association or a fair district, then that can in fact happen, and then it's set out for how that in fact is accomplished. Now, the one thing that you'll find in there is that that it's limited to one county. And it'll be a county between with population between 400,000 and 600,000, and that, in fact, is Washington County. Now, the reason is this, is that there's the Fair Boards Association, I think, was there are some of the associations, Fair Boards, are interested in this, but they've got different configurations, and they weren't really sure whether or not this would work for them, because there's, over time, these Fair Boards have been around a long time. We really didn't have time to look at whether or not this language would allow them to do that. So they said, why don't you guys go ahead? We're going to meet during the interim with the Association of Counties and the Fair Boards Association to see if we can work something out that would open this opportunity or option up for others. Well, I should also say, too, that I'm empowered to speak for the Association of Counties here this morning, too. And I was on the interim group that worked this out. That's what the A5s do, and I'd like to have Martha talk about what the Washington County says. Thank you, Dr. Clark.
Good morning, Chair Starr and Senator Beyer and the committee staff. We at the Washington County Fair, of course, are very pleased to finally see some language that will allow us to maybe do some things that we've been trying to do over a variety of years, but for whatever reasons, the mechanisms that were in place did not allow us to do that. One of the things I think Senator Starr or Chair Starr that we've talked in the past has been maybe the potential at some point of privatizing the fair if the counties and the fair board and the management of the fair felt that that was the prudent thing to do. I think the mechanism that we have before us would allow us to do that. The other thing is that some of the very differences that exist in Washington County in terms of the population count make this an attractive thing or attractive item for Washington County, in that we are one of the largest counties population, highly dense on the east side, and not quite as much on the west side, which is also where the fair complex is located. We hope that this will also allow us to create a tax district if we needed so, in which we would be able to tax in the areas that would be in and around the fair complex and help us then potentially do some funding mechanisms that we would need in order to improve facilities or what have you out of the fair complex. So if you have any questions of me or the rest of the individuals that are here, we'd be more than happy to entertain your questions.
Any questions? Senator Beyer.
The whole bill applies only to Washington County?
Senator Starr, Senator Beyer, and no, only the part that pertains to the privatization.
Does this conflict with home rule charters of the counties that have them?
Washington County is home rule county. We had our attorneys look it over in there. It works this far.
So they don't have the counties that are home rule under their charters don't have the authority now to remove members from their fair board?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, as we understand it, it is not clear that authority does exist. And some fair board members have been removed, but there it is not stated explicitly. We had asked LP for an opinion before we started this process, and it was their opinion that counties do not have that authority. So we thought it would be good to clarify it in the statutes and give it very explicitly that it is authorized.
these new special districts, who would appoint the board? Would they be elected?
The board, if I understand correctly, and you can clarify it, Dennis, but currently the county commission appoints the fair board.
I understand.
The committee that would be consistent, the six additional that would be to review the process, three would be appointed by the fair, and three would be citizens at large. Is that correct, Dennis?
Correct, but are you, you're talking about the appointment of...
Yeah, I'm talking about Section 5, which authorizes the formation of their districts to replace their boards. I haven't looked at this. The ORS citation, is that just the special district statute?
For creating, yes, special district statute. This is a regular, not a regular, but being the special districts, right.
So the boards under, most special district boards are elected.
Elected.
They're independent. The districts are independent of the counties.
Right. So it'll make for an interesting discussion about which direction they choose to go, whether or not they want to set up a private not-for-profit or a special district.
So I guess I was going to the next step to that. If it is a board that has special districts, would have taxing powers. These are two questions. In creation, would they trade with a tax base under Measure 50?
Well, that's a good question. I assume so, that it would be for a vote. They'd have to go out for a vote to get the funding base for themselves. If there isn't another...
So they'd have to do that through an election.
Correct.
Yes.
Is an election required for the establishment of a special district?
Yes.
So that would be part of that, the
authorization
issue. So I assume then if you were having the board of taxing authority, that you would have the board of directors would be elected?
That's also correct, right. Mr. Chair, I might add, just on behalf of the Oregon Fairs Association, we do support the -A5 amendment, and as Mr. Mulvihill stated, we do need to spend some more time on this during the interim, because there are counties that view this differently. And so we would like that opportunity, but Washington County is interested in having this put in place now, and we agree with that. But there are other counties who may be interested in it, and we would like that next 18 months to look at that.
Appreciate that. Appreciate your bringing the matter to us. And we're going to close the public hearing. On House Bill 2766, we will open a work session on House Bill 2766. The let the administrator answer any questions Senator Courtney might have. We've heard that testimony. No opposition to this bill. The -5A5 amendments deal only with Washington County at the present time, and provide special provisions for them to look at a different way of operating the county fair in Washington County. I would entertain a motion to move the -A5 amendments.
You better do it, because I wasn't here. That'd be pretty serious responsible.
I would move that. I'd move the A5.
Senator Barr has moved the -A5 amendments to House Bill 2766. Any discussion? Any opposition?
For Senator Courtney's benefit, the A5s apply only to Washington County.
Yeah, he just said that. I understand that of the 36 counties, his county is the only one that we're going to take care of. His county, not towards the line.
That's
his baby. There's 36 counties, and all we're going to do is take care of Washington County. I understand what you're trying to say.
Yeah. Succinctly put, I am.
How about I?
Now, I do want to, before you go to the next one, I want to just ask a question, not to embarrass you, Mr. Chair, because I've already come in here and done an incredible amount of work in my short time here, unlike people who have been here for a long time who do nothing to show off and walk in at the last second and act like they're important. So, are you ready now to move the bill, Mr. Chair?
Is there no opposition to this amendment?
amendment?
I have none.
All right. So ordered.
Now, can I ask a question?
Well, you can, but I'd like to have a motion before us, and then we'll discuss the motion.
I'm moved. Okay, you go ahead and do what you guys do.
I'll move the bill to the floor for the debate.
The bill as amended, House Bill 2766, moves the floor of the Dupas recommendation. Questions?
But the longer I'm in this session, the more I realize there's only two counties in Oregon, Deschutes and Washington. And if you were this year, you know what I mean. Now that we've done this with this Washington, I guess the counties, all the other 35 counties are all right in terms of that. Not. Is that right or not? Can I have an answer to that question? If you can answer it.
They're fine with it. We passed that. They wanted to that.
No, they don't have to come up and testify. They've already testified. I don't want to screw things up. Just tell me.
Yes, okay.
They're okay.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I will move it and we'll vote to support this. I just want to let you know that I intend to go back and talk to mine, because I think if I were on a county commission in Wayne County, I would have a little bit concern about a change that affects their home rule authority. But apparently that's unclear, so I will be asking them if they're okay with it.
Would you allow me to do the same for Marion County? I mean, I do feel
we would like that. I think that's entirely permissible and an important way to proceed.
Okay.
This is a bill from the land of privatization.
Yes. Let's have a clerk call the roll.
Why, aye.
40 votes yes.
Senator
Aye. Senator Aye. I understand the necessary majority. House Bill 2766 moved to the floor with a new pass recommendation, and chair will carry. We were hoping a work session on this other bill, whichever one that was, but we didn't get a telecommunications timing bill. House Bill. Open a work session on House Bill 2576. Has no amendments.
I move. You want to move to the floor?
I'd like to move it.
How do you want
to? Learn tonight.
Excuse me. This one has two FTE involved. We must move it to Ways and Means.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2576 as is to the Ways and Means Committee with two pass recommendations.
Any further discussion?
Why
is there a fiscal impact? Mr. Mayor, it's going to die down there because Republicans haven't got enough money.
Sure.
Senator Beyer?
This is other funded and probably will move, but it has to go because of the two FTEs.
Right.
Must go to Ways and Means. It's ridiculous. We're using money to do this.
Okay.
Oh, well, we're just going to do it.
Further discussion.
I made a motion for
it. All right.
Okay, that's the way I do things.
Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Byers.
Aye. Aye. I've received the necessary majority. House Bill 2576 is moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. We have got to the end of our calendar.
We're done.
Just want you to know, in the short time that I've been on your committee, do you see how much I've already contributed? Obviously, if no one else is here, have you noticed? This is the first time you and I have ever been on a committee together.
Duly noted.
I am a man of action. I don't just come to sit around and talk.
Since there's no further business to be transacted,
we're going to get you right here on the committee, but adjourned. I voted.